Welcome to A Million Other Choices. Thank you for joining me. We discuss dark topics here, and sometimes things get hard to listen to. My focus is always on victims and their families and friends, which can be very hard to listen to, so please be advised of this. Ad-free episodes can be signed up for through Red Circle or Patreon, where you can also get access to full-length bonus content. You can make a one-time donation at Buy Me a Coffee. Disclaimer and sales pitch are done. Next up, legal. All sources are publicly available information, and I use a wide variety of sources to try to ensure accuracy, but I cannot confirm the accuracy of publicly reported information. If you would like a specific source or sources, please email me at amillionofthechoices@outlook.com and I will provide it to you. You can also email me there with case suggestions and just general comments. Okay, we are done. Let's get going with what you came here for today. I have a happy story for you today. Well, it's a happy ending story, but don't worry, it is still all tragic and awful and all the things that us true crime people come for. It just has a happy ending, so I'm very pleased to bring you something that's a little less dark than I usually do. Located in the center of the Santa Clara Valley on the southern shore of San Francisco Bay sits San Jose, California. As a population of just under a million people, it is notable for its tech industry. Giants such as eBay, Adobe, and PayPal, they're all headquartered there. It is considered one of the wealthiest cities in the world, has a very expensive housing market. And we should also remember and honor that before the arrival of the coloners, San Jose was home to the Taimian Nation and the Ohlone peoples of California. In 2003, on the south end of town, just before the 101 takes you further south to the South Santa Clara Valley, on a quiet cul-de-sac which is nestled between well-maintained houses with clean yards of a mix of ranch style and two-story homes, lived the Tomeo family. Mom Rosalia, stepdad, whom I wasn't able to track down the name of, and siblings Pablo and Jeanette. Pablo and Jeanette's dad had split from Rosalia a few years prior and occasionally saw the kids, but stepdad had taken his place with kindness and compassion and provided the stability and the everyday support that they needed. Rosalia had worked for Solectron for about 10 years in San Jose, and then she got laid off in early 2002, so the family moved for a time to San Diego, where she had some family and she could be closer to her mom and who lived in Tijuana. But the job market for her and her husband's career and their backgrounds left them with little funds, and they could only really afford a small apartment for the four of them. So they moved back to San Jose and then settled on Southwind Drive. And on the afternoon of June 6, 2003, which was a Friday, Rosalia and Pablo returned from her job and picking up Pablo from school. And they were running about 15 minutes later than they usually did. They normally made it home right around the same time that 9-year-old Jeanette got off the school bus. Now, Rosalia pulled into the driveway and they pushed the button on the garage door opener, but it only kind of budged a little bit and then it would stop. And after a couple of tries, 15-year-old Pablo got out, went to the door, and then just kind of bent over to try and heave the door up manually. And when he entered the dark garage, it took him a couple of seconds to kind of figure out what he was seeing. A man was putting his little sister into a car that he didn't recognize. He made eye contact with his sister and could see that she was terrified. He also didn't recognize the man, and Jeanette screamed at him to watch out, but he wasn't able to gather his thoughts in time, although he did manage to grab a screwdriver and charge at the man before the man grabbed him, twisted his neck, and started to beat him about the head and face, getting him on the ground, and was aiming or trying to aim to stomp on his neck. And then dragged him into the house through the internal garage door. Now, Pablo luckily had twisted out of the way, and Rosalie had seen what was happening. She had run through the front door of the house and tried to lure the man away from Pablo. Now, she was hoping not to have to sacrifice herself, but willing to if it came to that. So Rosalie grabbed a frying pan and tried to swing at the man, screaming at him, like, "What do you want? Like, why are you here?" But he managed to wrangle the frying pan away from her and then started to use it on her, answering her, "You know what I want." He left her there badly beaten, and then he fled out of the garage door and got into his car with Jeanette still tied and bound in the back seat. Rosalie staggered out onto the road, tried ineffectively to run after the vehicle with Pablo kind of limping behind her, but it was completely useless. The man and Jeanette were gone at that point. Rosalie screamed in the street for someone to call the police. And so, of course, police were called by a neighbor, Karen Camfolt, who at 4:37, which was only minutes after Pablo had opened the garage door, within an hour, any detective that had already gone home for the weekend was sent to the Tomeo house. Rosalie and Pablo were quickly sent to the hospital because they had been actually brutally beaten, both of them, and were both lucky to be alive. And Karen Camfolt, she's the one that had called the police. She was eager to show the police the tapes from her Ring camera. It might not have been a Ring camera in 2003, but she had surveillance cameras anyways, that had captured some grainy footage of a silver car that could have been an early 1990s Honda Accord with tinted rear windows. Ray Monson, who lived nearby, had noticed the same car parked outside of the Tomeo house between 1:30 and 2 that afternoon. And when he had pulled out of his own driveway at 2:20 to pick up his kid from school, there was a man sitting in the car and the two of them made brief eye contact. Ray did think it was a little bit odd that he would be parked there and sitting in his car all that time, but he kind of forgot about it by the time he returned later, and the car was no longer there at that point. There is a little bit of discrepancies in the reporting of the actual timelines here, so I'm going to be going by reports from the Tribune on June 8th, 2003, rather than more recent reports. But the actual times don't actually make a difference to the outcome of this story. They are all reported really close to these timelines anyways. On the surveillance video, that police could see that Jeanette had arrived home at 3:53 and then entered the house. And 1.5 minutes later, the man also entered the house. At 4:25, so about a half an hour he was in the house, he exits the house through the garage door and walks to his car, this 1990s Honda Accord, and backs the car into the garage and then closes the door. And a few minutes later is when Rosalie's car pulls into the driveway and Pablo gets out to open the garage door. So about 9 minutes after that, the man's car pulls out of the driveway and speeds off, trampling rose bushes along the yards in his hurry to get out of the neighborhood. But the footage was too grainy to get any good description of the man or a license plate, or even a partial license plate. You can then see Rosalie and Pablo limping after the car and screaming. The police spokesman, Steve Dixon, said the tape makes it very clear that he was targeting this house. He wasn't roaming the neighborhood looking for a house to break into. He was there for quite some time, just waiting for this little girl to come home. Now, fortunately, Pablo had an amazing memory, and had this man's image, of course, seared into his brain, and was able to give a pretty good description, which enabled them to make a composite sketch to go with the description of the car to put on the Amber Alert that was issued. He was a man. He wasn't all that tall, maybe 5'5" at best. Latino, dark hair, unshaven, wearing a gray beanie and silver-colored shirt. Pablo also told them that he had probably had some scratches on his face and arms from the struggle with him and his mom. So initially, police thought that this was maybe like a burglary gone wrong, but the man didn't really take anything from the house other than a few little token things. And of course, Jeanette, and the fact that the man was clearly targeting their specific house. So Steve Dixon said, it does help us narrow down the investigation, you know, that the attacker went straight to this house. But the question is, like, why? And why Jeanette? So over the next couple of days, about 80 volunteers and police searched creek beds, wooded areas, anything they could think of for traces of Jeanette. And about 100 tips came in the first 24 hours. They checked the activity of any and all local sex offenders and worked to get the tapes cleaned up enough that maybe they could get a license plate number, but they essentially had no leads on who could have taken Jeanette, what had been done to her, why she had been targeted, nothing. And flyers were printed and distributed starting that very night. And so that's how the afternoon of June 6, 2003 went for Rosalie and Pablo, which is horrific enough. But what was happening to little 9-year-old Jeanette during this time, who was now alone with a man that she had never met, torn from her home against her will? So on that afternoon, Jeanette had a normal day at school, arrived home at her usual time. She got off the bus and she got her key out to open the door. And the usual routine was that she would arrive home from school and her mom would come home about a half an hour later so that she wasn't left to her own devices more than maybe an hour at the most. And on this day, she noticed that the screen door to the house was slightly ajar, and she thought that maybe her mom had come home a little bit early. So she came in like kids do, shedding their coat and their backpack, called for her mom, and while she was doing that, she walked into her bedroom. Like, a bedroom is every 9-year-old sanctuary. Only when she got to her room, she was stopped in her tracks when she saw that her window had been smashed. And there was glass littering the floor everywhere. So something told her that this wasn't just like maybe a wayward softball that had broken her window. So she immediately ran for the nearest phone to call her mom's cell phone. But she quickly discovered that the line to the landline had been cut. She then heard a knock at the door, just a gentle knocking. She thought, oh, maybe it was just a wayward baseball and somebody was just kind of coming to say that they were sorry and that they would pay for it. So she rather timidly opened the front door, and there was a man that she did not recognize who started asking her some questions. And while he's asking her the questions, he's kind of looking around behind her, like kind of trying to peek his head in. And Jeanette did not like this one bit and started to close the door on him. Only he put his hand between the door and the frame to stop her from pushing back on the slight weight that she was trying to put on the door. This is all so terrifying. Like, I cannot imagine at that age. I can't imagine at my age, let alone when you're 9. So he opened the door wider and grabbed Jeanette before she had a chance to even try and turn away from him. He carried her to her brother Pablo's bedroom, threw her down on the bed, grabbed at her, climbed on top of her, tugging off her pants, and violated her. He then handcuffed her and tied her legs together. And then he gathered her up, weeping and broken, of course, and carried her out to the car that he had backed into the garage while she had been tied up and unable to escape. He put her in the back seat and was preparing to leave when Rosalie and Pablo arrived, which of course threatened to foil his plans. So Jeanette could see that the man She could see what the man was doing to her brother in the garage and was trying to call out and scream for help. But once Pablo was dragged inside, she heard some scuffling and some screams, and then everything went quiet. And so then the man came back out and got into the car. Jeanette at that time was sure that the man had just killed her mom and her brother. But as they pulled away from the house, she did manage to turn her head out of the back window to see her mom limping towards the car and Pablo sort of close behind her, wildly throwing their arms around. So she was thankful in that moment to see that her family was still alive, because of course she wasn't sure that she was going to be for much longer. Now, it wasn't a long drive that they went on, but Jeanette tried to take in all the landmarks that she could, hoping that it might one day lead to finding where she had been taken and by who. The house itself was unassuming for the most part, looked like most of the houses in her own neighborhood. It was a little less well-kept than hers, and the way her neighbors had been kept, but it was normal-looking. He parked the car in his own garage and then carried her into the house, into a small bedroom that contained just a bed, a TV. It had its own bathroom, and then there was a window in there. The man released the ties on her legs, but kept her handcuffed. He violated her innocence and childhood many, many times over the coming days. Yes, it was days. But Jeanette was really, really smart. Like, she was also a true crime girl after my own heart. She loved shows like CSI, Law and Order, and The Detectives, which a lot of us would think would maybe terrify children and kids and maybe they shouldn't be watching them. But from someone that secretly read Ann Rule books and listened to my parents watch 60 Minutes on Sunday nights, you do you, Jeanette, like littlest warrior. Jeanette remembered from these shows, there was two key things to help get out of these situations and to help get justice for whatever was to come. One of them was manipulation, to try to talk to the person, make sure that they see you as a real person. And two was to get evidence and leave evidence. So Jeanette started slowly. She had to quell down her fear as best she could, not to mention her hatred of this man, but this monster, really, and asked him a few questions about himself, like just small talk stuff, try to get him to maybe open up or at least see her as a person, like maybe someone that wasn't a threat to him. And she had tried to remember the turns and the distances to his house to retrace the path from her place to where she was now, but those memories were starting to quickly escape her. She had discovered that the handcuffs that he forced her to wear were actually mechanical ones, so they didn't need a key. They just needed the dexterity to unlatch them. So during the day, she would unlatch them, and when she heard the man's footsteps coming, she would like quickly jump back into bed and put them back on. She made sure, of course, that she kept them always like really near her in case he walked a bit faster than usual into the bedroom. She used the time that she was out of those handcuffs to secure a few small items of evidence to connect her to this man. There was a watch, a small toy, and her underwear. And she hid them between the mattress and the box spring. And whenever she was given a chance to speak to him, she told the man about her family and how much she loved them and her plans that she had for the future to kind of force him to see her as the young girl that she was with a life ahead of her. It must have worked to some degree because when he tried smothering her with a pillow one time, she begged him not to kill her and he did relent. The man had the TV on in the background a lot for something for her to listen to. And surprisingly, he didn't turn it to like a kid's channel and ran the risk that the news would be seen. And Jeanette actually caught a report about testing some kind of medication on rabbits for asthma. And so that night she told him that she had asthma and also some kind of contagious disease. And if she didn't get her medicine soon, she was going to die. And it was a ploy that might have had some kind of effect on him. So on the third night of her capture, the man surprised her by asking her if she was hungry. And she said she was and that she wanted pizza. So that night, Little Caesars received a call to order a pizza. And the girl on the phone spelled out the address slowly, letter by letter, Dear Well Way. Her voice was timid, but she didn't mention anything about being held hostage. Just gave the pizza order, spelled out the address, and thanked the lady on the phone. The delivery driver had no idea that this was not going to be any ordinary pizza delivery, but it actually went down like every other pizza delivery that he had that night. He pulled up to the house, and it's one of those houses. I'm not sure what they call the layout. Like, it's where you come in the front door, there's a small landing for your, like, your shoes and your coat, and then you either go directly upstairs to the main level with a, like, the kitchen and the bathroom, the living rooms and the bedrooms, or you go downstairs to the basement, which is usually like a finished basement with like a rec room down there. And it was one of those houses. Anyways, the owner of the house came to the door to get the pizza and then went upstairs. And what made this delivery both extraordinary and ordinary was that the Little Caesars location that the pizza order was delivered to was one that was close to Southwind Drive, where the Tomeo family had lived. And as a result, with every pizza that was ordered, you were given a flyer of a picture of Jeanette on it about her being missing. Now, this particular pizza delivery drop-off was no different than that, but the man who paid for the pizza knew who this little girl on the flyer was. So with a rather wild look in his eye, he said to Jeanette, I have to get rid of you tonight. Now, Jeanette wasn't sure if that meant she was going to be let go or if he was going to kill her. She was, of course, terrified to find out which it was going to be. But she could tell that either way, like, at least her ordeal was going to be over very soon. Now, it was dark out when he put Jeanette into his car. This time she got into the front seat and drove for a short distance. Jeanette, again, she took in all the landmarks as best she could, trying to memorize the distance. He turned and stopped in the parking lot of the East Palo Alto Market. He pulled her hair, dragging her head like close to his mouth and said, I'm letting you go. But if you ever tell anybody what I did or who I am or anything about me, I'm going to come back for you and I'm going to kill your family and I will kill you too. He then reached over and opened the passenger door and let her out into the night. Jeanette ran towards the first building that she saw, which was a liquor store owned by Isa Yazin, who noticed the little girl come in and at first assumed that she was maybe like a runaway. And she asked Isa for a cell phone and watched as she started to dial a local number. Now, looking at her, taking in the time, he realized that this girl in front of him was the same girl from the posters and the flyers that had been circulating. So he called 911 reporting that Jeanette Tomeo had been found and was standing right in front of him at the moment. So, of course, the police rushed to the liquor store, arriving at around 10:30 that night. That was the night of June 8th, almost 3 days since her kidnapping. One of the officers gingerly approached Jeanette, who was, of course, wide-eyed and terrified, and asked her, like, you know, if she remembered anything, and she reached into the pocket of her pants and slowly started to pull out some items, her underwear, a watch, and a small toy. When Jeanette had been allowed to get dressed for this final car ride, she had crept her hand between the mattress and retrieved the items that she had taken as evidence and then pocketed them. The officer then asked if she maybe remembered anything else, like anything about the house or the man that could maybe help them find him. And she meekly asked for a piece of paper to write on. And when given to her, she wrote down the address at Dear Well Way and the phone number that she had called from. She had memorized it when he gave her the information for the pizza order. She also remembered the Little Caesars location that they had ordered from and directions from the mall to his house, and that his name was David. And investigators that were back at the pizza restaurant were confirmed that the delivery had been made to that address. So the San Jose Deputy Police Chief Rob Davis said, quote, "She said and did things which helped her to the point where the suspect at certain times, I believe, saw her as a human being, not as an object. She was just really sharp. She developed a rapport with this guy to the extent that she needed to," end quote. And so officers quickly went to the Little Caesars to confirm the order and the address that the house was delivered to. Meanwhile, another officer put Jeanette into the back of a police cruiser and followed her directions. And of course, time was of the essence, as Jeanette had said that this David guy had mentioned that he might consider fleeing to Mexico or Los Angeles. So 9-year-old Jeanette, who again, I will remind you, she's 9, pointed to a house that was not that far from her own house. When they got to this Deer Well Way, it had some weeds in the yard and there were sheets covering the window. And she said, like, that's it. That's the one. So Jeanette was quickly taken to the hospital to be reunited with her family and get treated and looked over. And of course, a rape kit done. And the police worked to get a search and arrest warrant on one David Montiel Cruz, who was registered at that address. Now, his real name is Enrique Sosa Alvarez. He was 23 at the time. Now, some reports say he was 26, but I think that was actually when he was sentenced. Now, apparently there was an anonymous phone call that had come in on that night of the 8th after Jeanette had been released, letting police know that this David was hiding in the attic. And that is, in fact, where they found him. But investigators have refused to discuss this call or reports also of a car scene that was pausing next to David's car on Karen's surveillance videos. So chances are neither is true. Like, no one else has ever been arrested in this case. So as far as I know, David worked entirely alone. Anyways, the police raided the house just before dawn on the Monday. They found some evidence that he was planning an escape, and Enrique, or David, or whatever you want to call him, was found in the attic, and police dogs had been called on him, so he had a few good bites just for good measure on him. His car also matched with the one that matched the surveillance tapes, was found in his garage, as well as fingerprints were found of his in the Tomeo house. Now, before the dogs got to him, they already noticed that he had some scratches on his face, just like Pablo had said he likely would have. And that evening, a photo of this David Enrique was shown to Pablo, and he said, like, that's him. He's the one that beat me up and kidnapped my sister. So he was booked on 9 felony charges, including sexual assault, battery, and robbery, among some other felonies. He was sentenced to 100 years in prison. And shortly after her abduction, Rosalie was asked to sort of describe her daughter and what the next steps were going to be for her. And she said, quote, "She was very smart. She's a super child. She's more intelligent than I am. The most important thing for me is for her to move forward with her life. It's a miracle," end quote. Now, the trek out of her trauma was not a very easy one. Jeanette struggled for years with PTSD and fears of even leaving her house. She was literally paralyzed by fear, like a fear of men. But she managed, after 6 years of intensive therapy, she finished school. She went into law enforcement with a goal of one day becoming a detective to sort of help her community and aid victims of violence in particular. She said, quote, "And no matter what life throws at us, no matter what obstacles, we're all fighters and we all have the ability to keep going. I turned my fear into courage. I got my family back," end quote. Jeanette did come forward in 2011 and did tell her story to Biography and ABC News, but has been living a really quiet life ever since. And so I'm going to leave her to that. I didn't really dig too much into what she's doing now or where she is or if she's had any kind of public life. I just think it's amazing that she survived what she did, that she was so smart about it, that she kept as calm as she could. And I honestly believe all of that saved her life, because I think I think if she hadn't tried to talk to him a little bit, he wouldn't have seen her as I think he would have seen her just as collateral damage, and that he needed to get rid of her in a different way if she hadn't have done that. So she's just a remarkable girl. Well, obviously she's now an adult, but it's a remarkable story, and I'm happy that it had such a great ending for her. Certainly that she got the intensive counseling that she really would have needed, because although she had lived without that, it might not have been such a happy ending. She might have been left with so much trauma that her life didn't, you know, went in a different direction. So I'm happy that she got the therapy and counseling that she needed. It's just, what a great story. And I'm happy to bring it to you. So I'm going to be back again next week with another case. I think next week is a pretty long one, so get ready for that. In the meantime, you do your thing, your rates, your reviews, your subscriptions. Don't forget that there is exclusive episodes and Patreon as well, which you can search for the exclusive on Red Circle, and you can search for the Patreon on patreon.com. You can also there's a buy me a coffee if you want to do a one-time donation. Don't feel obligated to do any of that stuff. It's just stuff I have out there that the money just helps me pay for some of the subscriptions I have for archives, some software that I use, stuff like that. But again, don't feel obligated. I'm just happy that you're here with me every week. And thank you so much for listening.